This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The U.S. relied heavily on Wilmington during World War II. The city and its surrounding area were home to all five military branches and considered the defense capital of the state. Wilmington was also the chosen site for the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company, which built close to 250 vessels for the war. The Liberty ships launched into the Cape Fear River, and they were considered some of the best and most efficiently built of their time. The shipbuilding boom transformed the economy and the culture of Wilmington and shaped it into the port city it is today. The story of Wilmington's Liberty Armada is featured in a new series from Our State magazine. The series is called 1940s, the Decade of Transformation. Each month this year, the magazine will highlight moments from that decade that shaped what North Carolina looks like today. And joining me first is the author of that series, Philip Gerard. He's a professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Welcome.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit. Tell us more about the shipbuilding company that extended. Shipbuilding, of course, had gone on. We think of Wilmington as a port city, but in fact, and certainly important in the Civil War and World War I, I was surprised to read it all kind of came to a halt in 1918.
Yeah, it did. And there had been a movement for years to try to restore it on the river, and the opportunity came when we ended World War II. And it was clear because, you know, we're a continental island, essentially. If you're going to go to war, you have to put things on ships and take them great distances across the ocean. And we did not have that much of a merchant fleet. So the existing shipyards, including the Newport News Shipbuilding Company in Virginia, couldn't handle the new demand. And so they were asked to branch out, and they chose the site in Wilmington over Morehead City, I might add.
Yeah, a little competition there,
right? Which was a rival for it.
Well, how did they – let me stop you there. What was the deciding factor or factors that let it go to Wilmington?
I think the deciding factor was, one, it was far enough so they could branch out. It was far enough from Newport News, and that was important for defense reasons. You don't want to put everything in one place where it can be sabotaged. It was also a river that opens directly onto the sea. It was an easy place to get a ship out into the ocean to go to Charleston, to go north to New York or what have you. And there was also a ready supply of workers. There was a lot of land that was cheap. And in fact, some of it looks like they simply took and worried about the deeds later on. So there was land to expand on, and the shipbuilding company became huge during the war.
And we're talking again about mostly cargo vessels, right? These are the so-called Liberty ships. So tell us about these vessels.
They did something very smart. By they, I mean the U.S. Maritime Commission. They decided that rather than have 50 or 60 different designs of ships and have to draft all those designs and train engineers to make them, train workers to build them, they settled on one design. They adapted it from a British cargo model. And the one design could be modified to include tankers and what have you. It could also be fitted with anti-aircraft guns for defense. And the other innovation was these were going to be made in modules, not riveted the way, if you've ever seen the building of the Titanic footage, for example, they're riveting. These were going to be gigantic sections that would then be hoisted into place and welded together. And the thinking was that they wouldn't last very long.
Well, the Titanic certainly didn't, so why would you go with that process? Go ahead.
The thinking was that they would last long enough to get the job done, and because they could be built cheaply and quickly, then they could be built in great numbers very quickly, which is, in fact, what happened. And then, to everyone's surprise, they lasted for generations on the ocean.
They welded these things. So tell us a little bit more of this. It's also interesting, too, the backstory of the company, the spinoff that became the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company, but the Newport News Shipbuilding Company was the parent, right?
Right, and that was run by a guy named Homer Lenore Ferguson, who was a North Carolina native and who had gone to study in Scotland with some of the greatest naval architects of the age. And Scotland, by the way, is where all those fast blockade runners came during the Civil War. They were built on the Clyde River, and they ended up in Wilmington. So he got into shipbuilding for the Navy initially and then got sort of dissatisfied with the pace and the bureaucracy, and after building several large ships for them, went with the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company. When his predecessor went down the Lusitania in World War I, they elevated him to run the company. He was a hands-on guy. Knew every aspect of it. He was all for the workers. He wanted clean living conditions, clean working conditions. They had childcare on premises, things that we think of as progressive today. And but he was very anti-union. Kind of a Scotsman.
Very interesting in terms of, and we may or may not know his attitudes on race, but when it came to building a product, he was not about to let things like racial segregation get in the way of a good ship, right?
No, he believed in meritocracy, and he was unusual among many, even Southern shipbuilders and Southern industrialists in general, in that he would hire black men for skilled labor and pay them the same as he would pay whites. Now, in the event and in North Carolina, the workers worked in integrated gangs, although there were facilities such as dining and restrooms and so forth that were segregated. But it really opened the door, because what happened at the beginning of the war was there was so much work to be done, so many soldiers were being drafted or volunteering, that the available manpower was simply disappearing. And so into that void, if you will, first came a lot of black men and then came women. And women turned out to be a hugely valuable part of the workforce in Wilmington, not just doing clerical stuff, but welding, plumbing, helping to build engines.
Eventually, they moved into the heavy lifting, right?
Yeah, they were. And they sort of initially were not, but then they proved themselves so adept at filling in for these jobs that they just gradually took them over. And as men left to go into the service, more and more women joined the working the work gangs.
Yeah, then they became Rosie the Welder, because we're not riveting the ships. It takes too long.
Right.
All right. So we got all that worked out. Very interesting stuff. What's happening to the city of Wilmington at this point in terms of population? And, yeah, what's it looking like?
Well, you're adding 25,000 people and a $50 million payroll.
So give me a sense of what was the population? I mean, in terms of percentage, you're adding 25,000 people to how big
you're
a city?
You're probably at that point about more than doubling it.
Wow.
You know, I mean, or thereabouts. And the other thing you're doing is, of course, on the heels of a depression when there was not much of a cash economy in eastern North Carolina, suddenly people have really good paying jobs and they've got places to spend the money. There are all kinds of nightclubs and USOs opening up. There's it may be the greatest generation in terms of, you know, all the honor duty country stuff, but they also knew how to party. I mean, these people were having a good time. Yeah. They were young people living away from home for the first time, single women now boarding with families in rooming houses with a great degree of freedom that they would not have had living in their parents' homes. And so there was a real kind of vibrancy. Wilmington became this lively boom town. There was always something going on, and because the work was going on 24/7, it never closed.
Yeah, well, therein lay one of the problems, in that sometimes you had to do this stuff by night and you had to use spotlights, and that became dangerous work.
Sure. Wilmington was chosen partly because they knew they could work outdoors in all weather, and ships are big. You've got to build mostly outdoors. And to facilitate this, they put up about 2,000 floodlights, and so the place was lit up like, you know, the mothership from outer space day and night, and people worked in all weather. They worked 24 hours a day, you know, three shifts, and workers typically work 7 days a week and occasionally had a day off. But the problem would be on a cloudy night without much moon, if a ship was passing off Cape Fear, a submarine out to sea could watch it be silhouetted against the loom of the shipyard lights. And in fact, a ship was sunk in 1942 exactly that way. And one of the things that happened was that the shipbuilding company no longer took its vessels out into the open ocean for sea trials. They did it all in the river from that point on.
And of course, that's the value of having this river that opens into the ocean.
Yeah, right? It turned out to be extremely valuable, yeah, because, as you know, the Cape Fear has a very wide estuary, right. So there's a lot of room to play around out there.
So now talk about the first ship, because then there was a controversy over naming it, although we could renew the controversy today. But let's talk about what was going on in the 1940s.
Well, the first ship to come off the ways was the Zebulon B. Vance, named for the most famous, probably the most popular North Carolina governor in history up to that point, except for Broughton, who was governor and had been elected by a landslide, whose wife actually christened the Vance. But initially, the commission, the Maritime Commission, had decided to name the first seven or eight ships all after either people from South Carolina or people who had been colonial generals from, you know, the North, from Rhode Island or Connecticut or wherever. And this caused an outrage. And in fact, the Chamber of Commerce protested to Emory S. Land, who was the head of the Maritime Commission. And at the last minute, they said, okay, we're gonna change naming here, and Vance will be the first one. And it became the signature ship. It served in Europe. It went on the Murmansk run, which, if you know from movies, was the great dreaded run across the Baltic to supply Russia. It was part of the invasion of North Africa, which was the first big Allied offensive after the war got underway. And it ended up as both a hospital ship and then later on actually finished its career in the war by carrying war brides home. Principally German and French women who had married American servicemen. So it not only survived the war, and 27 of its sister vessels did not, it actually pretty much did every role that a vessel like that had been built to do. and it did it extraordinarily well.
I'm talking to Philip Girard, who is the writer of a series of articles for Our State magazine, this first in a series that takes a look at the 1940s, a series of a decade of transformation for the state of North Carolina. Philip Girard has written about the shipbuilding industry and how it expanded during World War II. And joining the conversation now is Wilbur Jones. He is an author and military historian who champions the effort to revive recognition for Wilmington's contributions to World War II. And he joins us from partner station WHQR in Wilmington. Wilbur, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you very much.
You were a child in Wilmington at the time of World War II. Tell us about your memories of this expansion and shipbuilding.
Well, I have extensive memories. I remember what I was doing the day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and America went to war. And during those days, without television and handheld video games and such, we boys played war games and pretended that we were Marines on Guadalcanal and Tarawa and Iwo Jima and soldiers in the Battle of the Bulge. But I am a retired Navy captain, 41 years in the Department of Defense serving. And I guess I was cut out to be that person and also to be a writer. I have written 18 books, and 7 of them have been on World War II. 2 of the most popular books are on Wilmington and southeastern North Carolina.
Well, certainly, and I can understand why, because that explosion at the time, to think about a city that nearly doubles in population and suddenly becomes, you know, awash in cash, and also the importance. What was it like for you? I mean, you heard Philip talk about not only the importance of the war and kind of nose to the grindstone supporting the war effort, but, you know, having a good time. Did you, I mean, you're just a boy at the time, but did you feel that things were changing, and how so?
Oh, yes. My parents were very active in the war effort, and particularly in the Hannah Block Historic USO Community Arts Center, which was the second in Orange USO, and has now been renovated and restored to what it looked like during the war. And I have very vivid memories of those war years and my friends and how we would keep track of what was going on. And of course, we saw a different side of it than perhaps the side that Philip Girard has very aptly and ably described. That was one side of it. But Wilmington just came apart at the seams with the exploding population and the infrastructure problems. So there was a time when we, through our rationing and with the population explosion, we almost ran out of food, so I understand. And so the research I have done over the years and the involvement that we've had in not only the legacy, not only the contribution that Wilmington made during the war, and certainly the Wilmington Shipyard was one of the principal reasons that we made a major contribution to the war effort. But we had all 5 of the armed services who were stationed here or nearby. We had 3 German prisoner of war camps. The Atlantic Coastline Railroad headquarters was here in Wilmington. It was one of the largest railroads in the South. And also, very prominently, we had from our White High School, out of our high school, we had 2 Medal of Honor recipients. And to our knowledge, this is the only high school in the nation that had multiple Medal of Honor recipients in World War II. Now, we have, over the last 20 years, undergone a major effort to preserve this legacy. And in working, I've been working now going into 10 years to preserve this legacy and have Wilmington designated as the first American World War II city, because when Wilmington began this project in 2007 and kicked it off, it was 65 years after the war was over. No city had proclaimed itself as America's World War II city, and Wilmington, of course, was a boom town and died out after the war, whereas some of the other boom towns continued to survive. Now, we have made a concentrated effort in the last 20 years to preserve this legacy, built around this restored and renovated World War II USO building, and with events for veterans, USO dances, memorials, monuments, guided tours, maps.
Well, and now, Wilbur, I have to say, this series in Our State magazine that kicks off with a look at and a snapshot of Wilmington as a shipbuilding city in World War II. And joining our conversation now is Elizabeth Hudson, who's the editor-in-chief of Our State magazine. Elizabeth, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us more about the story of Wilmington. Is actually the first of a 12-part series year. So tell us about this series.
That's right. Well, I'll back up a little bit and tell you that in 2011, we launched a series devoted to the Civil War, and we did a chronology of the Civil War and carried it through 4 years that Philip Girard also wrote for us, and it was just so extraordinary. I mean, I know he's exhausted by it, but it was just wonderful. Our readers loved it. It got such a tremendous reception in the magazine, and I really was looking for something else that we could take on that would be just kind of a deep dive into a topic, you know, just something that we could explore. Philip is just such an extraordinary storyteller, and I really, you know, was looking for a way to keep his voice in the magazine. And I was kind of looking around to think, you know, what could we reflect on in our state? You know, we have an 84-year history ourselves, and so what can we do and think about that might have a historical narrative to it? And, you know, it's funny, you see right now that it feels like we're in this retro revival in a way. You know, there's this wave of nostalgia. You see it in the smallest places, like the return of record players, and how vinyl sales are, you know, I think I read that last year they were up more than they've been up in 40 years or something like that. And you're seeing craft cocktails that have come out of the 30s and the 40s. And, you know, there are all these little details, the home canning movement that's back in vogue. You know, I think I saw a photo actually of the First Lady, Kristen Cooper, she cans her own pickled okra. And, you know, so I really kind of got enamored with a time period that was looking back. And I was trying to think, okay, so if we launch a series devoted to decades in North Carolina, where to start, you know, and the 1940s just seemed like such an era that was just ripe for a deep dive.
Why is that? Why would the 40s? Really, why start
well,
there?
You know, I mean, part of it is instinctive. I mean, part of it is, like I say, you know, kind of watching some of these retro revival pieces that are coming out. A lot of these were actually born out of the 40s. You know, you're looking at so many changes that happened in the state that are still resonating and reverberating even now, you know, that really started in the 40s. Military bases and just all these things that created the landscape of North Carolina as we know it now. So it really was maybe this touchstone to history that is still, you know, Philip, you could certainly speak to this, that really we still have a connection to. And I mean, you know, if you want to expand on
that. Well, yeah, and the fact is you've got some informants who are still with us and can tell you their story from their own mouths.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, I would say that the 1940s is that decade where the past, you know, real history and sort of contemporary history meet. There are many people who remember, as Wilbur does, being a child. I've interviewed many people who were young at that time. The older generation that built the ships, that built the Fontana Dam, that served in the war, most of those have passed away at this point. But it really is that moment, as Elizabeth is saying, that North Carolina was one thing before the war. After the war, it's a very different thing. And those changes were permanent. They were baked in by the war. In an odd way, the war was one of the best things that ever happened in North Carolina. All the benefits that accrued that wiped away the effects or a lot of the effects of the Great Depression and left us in a very different place than we were, say, in 1939, 1940.
So, Elizabeth, maybe you can give us a preview. What else are we, what other decades?
And Philip has got a lineup that is just going to be so extraordinary. We were just talking about how excited we are. You know, for our February issue, which we're working on now, we're going to talk about the music of the 40s. And, you know, you're talking about Thelonious Monk and Coltrane and Earl Scruggs and really just it's amazing what happened with radio. And, you know, of course, the military bases. And we've got a great lineup for the rest of the year of a lot of things that I think still have have relevance now.
We will check in with you periodically. Pleasure to talk with you now. Philip Girard, a professor of creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and the author of a new series in Our State magazine called The 1940s, Decade of Transformation. Philip, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Hudson is editor-in-chief of Our State. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
And Wilbur Jones, a writer and military historian who is still fighting for the effort to get Wilmington designated America's World War II city, joining us from WHQR in Wilmington. Wilbur, thank you.
Thank you. And for your listeners, contact our Senators Burr and Tillis and our members of Congress to continue pushing for this legislation.
Got it all at the website, stateofthings.org. The untold story of black soldiers who built the Alaska Highway during World War II. That's up in a moment. Please stay tuned.